One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hall.
And folks, this one's a long time coming. Our guest today is just one of the best writers on film and television in the business. He is the editor-at-large and film critic of RogerEbert.com, features writer for New York Magazine and Vulture.com, contributing writer for D Magazine and Texas Highways, and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Criticism. He's also the author of many fine books, including the New York Times bestsellers The Sopranos Sessions, Mad Men Carousel, and the Wes Anderson Collection, as well as TV, the book, The Deadwood Bible, A Lie Agreed Upon, and The Oliver Stone Experience. He is also the creator of MZS.press, the online arts bookstore, which stocks all of his books and some of mine, too. So please welcome our pal and yours, Mr. Matt Zoller-Seitz. Hi, Matt.
Hi. What an introduction. Wow. Thank you.
I mean, there's you are a busy dude, like between all of your outlets and the books and the bookstore. Like, I feel like as a serious, like practical, logistical opening question, but a serious one. How do you manage to be so prolific? Like, do you run on 4 hours of sleep? Like, what is
No,
your
there's
secret?
Three people. There's Matt, there's Zoller, and there's Seitz. And the three of them, there's just, this is the fate, the representative of the
right.
Three. You never meet Zoller and Seitz.
It's like a Michael Keaton in Multiplicity sort of situation.
I was thinking more like Voltron. Maybe, like all joined together.
There you go.
I mean, I'm not as prolific as I was 20 years ago, that's for sure. And I, you know, with the store, my partner in business and life, Judith Carter, she runs the store. Like, mm-hmm. I'll promote the store and I'll make contact with authors and a few other little things, but that's Judith's baby. So I can't, I can take barely any credit for that aside from having started it.
Yeah.
But you know, the rest of the writing stuff, you know, it's changed because I find that I'm writing, except for the regular film reviews for RogerEbert.com, I don't do television criticism anymore, so I'm not chained to my desk basically right. continuously. Like, you know, that's the thing is like you don't really think about this when you think I'd like to be a TV critic. Is if you're a movie critic, there's a movie and you see it and that's the end of it, unless there's a sequel or something. Yeah. And with a TV show, it's like, here's season one, and it's 10 hours.
Right.
You know, so that adds up. But yeah, I'm spending more time on fewer things, and they tend to be longer, more complicated things. Like, I'm about to drop a really, exhaustively researched feature story on Vulture, maybe next week, maybe this week, maybe next. But that's something I've been working on for 3 months in dribs and drabs, so... That's sort of how I'm trying to roll these days.
Got it. Well, I mean, that leads into sort of the other question that I wanted to ask, which is, you know, at this point in your career, what is the work that you enjoy most and that you get the most out of? And are they two different things, I guess?
Well, I know, you know, you know how this is. Like, I don't like writing, but I like having written.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've never really gotten over that procrastination, that kind of dread of the blank page. And basically what I have to do is I just have to sit. I just have to sit and endlessly retype stuff and think that's garbage. And then at some point, all of a sudden I'm writing and it's like I always compare it to it when you get on a roller coaster and the coaster seems to take forever going up that first hill. And then once you get over it, everything's, you know, a breeze. But what gives me the most pleasure, like professionally, probably editing, probably video editing.
Really?
Probably video. Yeah. And I haven't done any video essays in several years, that weren't in partnership with an editor, but editing film and video is probably the most pleasurable thing for me. It's probably the closest I'll ever get to being a musician, which, you know, most of the people in my family growing up were musicians, and I never was. You know, I can barely carry a tune in a bucket. But
I've been saying that shit for years. Everybody looks at me like I'm nuts. And I've never heard anybody else say it before. And I don't that is incredibly validating to hear you say. I can't pick out a four-note song on a guitar. I couldn't even make a sound come out of a trumpet. But if your editing doesn't have a musical rhythm, it better be on fucking purpose. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same sort of thing. And you're counting in beats a lot of times. But it's not like sort of like a four on the floor. It's like the beat of a person's breath if you're doing an interview or something like that. And like... tuning into the rhythm of speech or to the rhythm of a room or something like that, especially if you're trying to work with sound, captured sound, and not just like throwing down a song like that. There's a rhythmic element to that that I have only ever heard musicians talk about in a way that seems relatable. And I can't, as an editor, explain it well. It's just, it's a feeling that I think is real. Oh my God. Thank you for saying that. This interview is going spectacularly so far.
Well, I don't see it as, I don't see it as being terribly different from when I'm writing. I'm sort of a writing coach for younger writers at RogerEbert.com particularly, but I've been doing that for 20 years ever since. I started a blog called The House Next Door, which a lot of younger writers kind of came through and went on to bigger things. Some of them were already very accomplished, but I think everybody who kind of committed themselves to that found themselves a bit, you know, in the process. And so that was a source of great pride. But they don't have, you know, journalism schools don't even know what to teach anymore. And the old industry where you could come out, get out of college and go get a job at the, you know, the Buck Snort Weekly Courier and learn the basics of the craft, that's kind of gone. And so what you have is people my age, I'm in my 50s, like we're the last generation that came up in newspapers and magazines. And we know, you know, we're all like, you know, Luke Skywalker with the green milk on his mustache, like we're living out on an island somewhere and we know the old skills. And, you know, I mean, you know, and it's not anybody's fault. I mean, like, I pity anybody who's coming out of college right now and trying to just learn the basics of, like, what's a feature story, what's an editorial, what's a classic, all things to all people review, that kind of stuff, you know. So but what I was getting towards was one thing that I tell them is don't make your sentences all the same length. You know,
tempo.
Like study musicians that you like and study athletes, like particularly boxers. You see the boxers, they're not punching all the time. A lot of the time they're just they're dancing, and then they come in and they take a few swings and, you know, shield themselves, and then they dance for a bit more. And that's, you know, that's a perfectly good analogy for what I think is interesting writing. And Roger Ebert was really good at that.
He'd
bust out a you know, like a sentence of almost Faulknerian complexity. And then at the end, he would say, you know, but right after that, it'd be like, see what I mean?
Right.
Like a little, like, four words, rather, you know.
That's some wax on, wax off shit, too, because just to even understand what you're talking about requires a certain grasp, a sort of a filter, just to be able to even understand what you're saying and apply it to writing. You know,
I always felt, you know, the more I got to know Jason, the more I felt like you were a kindred spirit, because we both seem to enjoy trying to sort of mix, like, you know, erudition and vulgarity.
Yes. <You know? laughs> there's equal importance to be placed upon each, I feel. Yes.
Yes, I'll drop, you know, so I'll, like, in the course of a review, I'll sometimes drop something. It's like, if you haven't had at least four semesters of film theory, you won't have any idea what I'm talking about. and then add, like, or fuck off.
Right. You know? Agreed.
You know.
Agreed.
So. Again, a filter. If you don't have the intellectual dexterity to deal with me at my Faulknerian best, fuck you at my, you know, gutter worst, right?
Yes. There you go. There's lots of different ways. There are a lot of different kinds of good writers. And sometimes I'm in a Hemingway, like, no adjectives, please, I'm dieting kind of mood. And sometimes it's like, let's see how long we can keep this sentence going before people start to go nuts. You know, it depends. So
it does.
Anyway. I enjoy talking craft with you guys, and I'm happy to do it all day, but I feel like we have a masterpiece to discuss.
We do.
Right, which is called The Sopranos. So you have a book about The Sopranos, and Jason just has a Gandolfini book, so I think clearly that's what we're here for, right? It's a master session on... No, that's not...
That's not it.
You know what? In a way, yes.
All right, Matt. So what film did you select to discuss today?
Well, if memory serves correctly, it's 2001, A Space Odyssey.
It just, it's spellbinding, even in a trailer.
Right. It's not going to play well for the audio version of the podcast, I should say, but the visuals are just astonishing. And
they are.
The music is, you know, recognizable.
We usually talk through these trailers, though, and all three, it's like we just got fed after, like, smelling the food for the last hour and a half. We're all just, like, staring at it. It's just, even in trailer, how many times have collectively we seen this movie? Couldn't even count.
You know, how many pieces of music on this soundtrack have become cliches?
Yeah.
Because of 2001. Like, I just heard the Blue Danube on a commercial, like, this week. And this Sprach Zarathustra is, like,
you can't use it for anything else.
Somebody using it.
Yes, that's true, too.
Nobody cared about that until Kubrick got a hold of it.
Oh, look at that.
I'm, like, holding up my lighter. Happy bird!
Ah. 2001, A Space Odyssey, in Cinerama, it reads. Very important. The most dazzling visual happenings in the history of the motion picture is the pull quote from Time magazine. And as pull quotes go, that's not too shabby. All right. So
that was fun. Okay, I'll see you guys later.
Oh my God.
I am going to do my setup piece very quickly since we have, by a considerable margin, our longest guide to the film for the Film Fanatic capsule review to date for Mike to read aloud. But 2001 A Space Odyssey, today's film, from 1968, was of course directed by the great Stanley Kubrick. His 4.5 to 5 years in the making follow-up to 1964's Dr. Strangelove, cementing him as one of the most important cinematic artists of his era. Mike, what does Danny Perry say about 2001 in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Danny says, the most awesome, beautiful, the visuals and classical music, mentally stimulating and controversial science fiction film ever made was directed by Stanley Kubrick, adapted from Arthur C. Clarke's short story The Sentinel by Kubrick and Clarke, and photographed by Jeffrey Unsworth and John Alcott, and features incredible Oscar-winning special effects by Wally Verriers, Douglas Trumbull, who supervised the miraculous Stargate sequence, Con Peterson, and Tom Howard. I don't know if he's got anything else that opens that affectionately or that like awesomely.
No, probably not.
It begins 4 million years ago when a black monolithic slab appears to a family of apes. Once peaceful vegetarians, they become meat eaters and intelligent enough to use bones as weapons to kill other animals for food and to chase other apes away from their territory. They have evolved into ape men, and their human descendants will retain their warring instincts. Progress and brutality go hand in hand. The territorial imperative and a notion of God. It is for the viewer to decide if the superior alien intelligence that sent the monolith and caused man to evolve from the apes instead of the neighboring tapirs is God as we define God. I had never made that. Yeah, we could have been pigs.
Yep,
McConaughey dragging on a joint. Gift, you know. And I say that with love.
Yes.
I say that with love. Because it invites that sort of scrutiny, shall you say. Yeah.
Film moves from the past to 2001 when Dr. Haywood Floyd, William Sylvester, an American scientist investigates the discovery of a monolith on the moon. The monolith sends a piercing signal through space's vacuum, a distant intelligence, no doubt, that man has evolved to the point where the monolith has been discovered. But man is nothing special. He is boring, untrusting. Floyd keeps the discovery secret from the Russians. Nationalistic, uncommunicative. While man has made great technical advances in communication, men are incapable of meaningful, intelligent conversation and are unworthy of their own scientific achievements. American big business has expanded. Pan Am, Bell Telephone, the Hilton chain, and Howard Johnson's are prominent at the space station. On a spaceship, we see the astronauts Bowman, Keir D'Elia, and Poole, Gary Lockwood, are completely subservient to a computer named Hal. Hal is actually more interesting than the men. They are mechanized. Hal is a neurotic. Hal, that sentence broke my skull.
Yeah.
Because it's so right.
Yeah.
Hal represents both a Frankenstein monster turning on its human creators. He tries to dispose of the crew. And a big brother, which, unlike the situation in Orwell, men intentionally have set up to spy on them. There is no scarier scene than when Hal reads the lips of Bowman and Poole as they plan to dismantle this rebellious computer. In an unforgettable scene, Bowman dismantles Hal. The battle between man and computer, resulting in Hal's death, releases emotions that Bowman had previously held in check, fear and sorrow. The destruction of the oppressive computer is the signal to the aliens, who may have set up the combat if we are to believe the dualist concept of God's omnipotence and man's having free will under God's auspices, that Bowman is worthy of being the human being who comes after them. Ugh. After traveling through space, the ultimate trip, Bowman finds himself in a terrarium observed by alien creatures. There he ages rapidly and becomes the first character in the film to eat at a table and the first to eat tasty food from a plate, too. He becomes civilized man. Kubrick believes that the missing link between the apes and civilized man is the human being, us. Lastly, Bowman dies and evolves into a star child floating through space toward Earth. The evolution of man from ape to angel is complete. Originally released in Cinerama at 160. It's so weird. The end of his thing is so, it's just like you get to the top of this amazing mountain.
And then he's got to wrap it up.
And then there's just like this bologna sandwich of a finish. Peter Hyams directed the badly muddled, forgettable 2010. Also with Daniel Richter, Leonard Rosseter, Margaret Tyzak, Douglas Rain as the voice of Hal.
Oh, I mean, funny. This is, I don't know of another one that I've read, certainly not one that we've done on the show, where he just walks through the entire movie, shares his philosophy on it, praises it, and that's it. Matt Zollersites, walk me through your history with this movie. When did you first see it? How did you first react to it? How has it figured into your life since?
Okay, so I'm going to start with a piece of lore.
Okay. All right, I'm ready.
My dad was a big fan of, you know, he loved movies. He didn't get to see them at night very often because he was a jazz musician, but he did make a point to see some of the big, like, conversation piece type movies, and he told me that he saw this movie more than once, and he seemed pretty convinced that one of their viewings of this movie, when him and my mom were on acid, resulted in my conception.
That is the best response to a request for a personal history of a motion picture that I could possibly ask for.
So I don't know how he could have done the math and figured this out. I don't know if it's, I know he believes it's true, so I'm just going to accept it.
Bro, you are the star child.
That's right.
So, you know, that's part of my origin story, at least according to my dad. And then my personal first viewing of it, I saw bits and pieces of it, I think, on Siskel and Ebert and probably other places. It was, you know, it's always, if you care about movies at all, you can't get through the first part of your life without being aware of 2001, even now.
Sure.
But I didn't see it until, like, the actual movie until I was, I think, 11 or 12 years old. There was a repertory theater in Dallas that I used to go to with my brother all the time. They had great stuff there. The Granada, it's now a live music venue. But I saw 2001 there, and I was blown away, and my mind was enlarged by it. I'd certainly never seen a science fiction movie like that. I knew that it was supposed to be more cerebral and difficult and perhaps obscure, you know, than, say, Star Wars or Close Encounters or Soylent Green or Logan's Run or whatever. Like, but I was unprepared for, I mean, that was an understatement. And I came out of it going, what the hell? I loved it though. I love the fact that it was that, you know, you're seeing for 2 hours and 20 minutes or however long it is, plus intermission, beautiful objects. You're seeing beautiful objects on the screen, beautifully designed, beautifully built, photographed, lit. Everything is like, you know, as Leonard Nimoy said on The Simpsons, the cosmic ballet begins, you know. It's really beautiful. Just, and that part of it, I was completely enraptured. I felt at the time that there wasn't a whole lot of plot, and I guess there really isn't in conventional movie terms, but I didn't care. And it reminded me of the only other movie I'd seen at that point that I think felt like it was Fantasia. You know, which was also driven by existing classical music, not a score, and also was just, I mean, you could make a case for, you know, I'm sure the people who animated it or Disney and his cohorts, you know, it's like, well, this sounds like there's a mushroom princesses frolicking around, and it's like, maybe, you know, but it doesn't. I don't care. Like, it's like an excuse. It's like a Disney gets to join forces with somebody like Tchaikovsky, you know? And I love that. So I didn't really begin to understand it until I started to see it again. And as I got older, and I think I've probably, this is one of the films I've seen the most times, and I love it in the way that I love my favorite albums of music. You know, I could just put it on and listen to it. I don't need to be quote unquote into it. I can just watch it. You know, if that makes any sense.
No, and check in on it occasionally, and Mike, what's your when did you first see this, and how did it hit you initially?
This movie, like, if you imagine your cinema journey as a mountain, and like at the bottom is Pulp Fiction, and at the top is like La Jetée, 2001 is like the biggest plateau on my personal mountain, because when we were watching movies together when we were kids, like, we were, it was all kung fu movies and bullshit, like parties, talking shit to girls, like black gangster movies for whatever reason. I mean, like, this was not on the fucking menu, you know. And then I moved and I'm living with Axel. I mean, like, so many times when we're talking about my movie origin stories, it's like, well, Axel was like, hey, you should watch this, right and then by the time you moved to New York, we had had like a 5 or 6 year sort of separation of like not living in the same place, not going to movies all the time. And I don't know what your process was, but we both had a real sort of evolution, you know, from sort of Scorsese and Wayans Brothers movies, like into a much more sort of interesting. I mean, we were, you know, I was 24 when I moved. Like, this is a natural thing, right? To in your 20s, find out there's something else in the world, you know, interesting, right? And this was it, man. When I was first living with him, he was like, this is both the greatest technical achievement in filmmaking history and the best movie ever made. And I was like, bro, come the fuck on. And the first time, two or three times he put it on, I fell asleep. And I was just sort of like, I don't know what you're talking about. And obviously the problem was me, not the movie. And then the next time I went and read about it, because by then I loved and respected him. And when he said something dramatic, like the best movie ever made, I was like, well, bro, you've seen 100 movies for everyone I've seen. So I went and read a little bit about it. And as with so many other things, like, that was the key for me to sort of getting a little bit more into understanding it. And once I sort of unlocked this movie, like, it unlocked magical realism. It unlocked, like, God, but not like the Christian crusader God, like as a concept that could be explored by humans. It was in some ways, like, this movie was a sort of path out of nihilism. This was a movie was a part of my, like, path out of nihilism, learning how to appreciate this movie. And there were other things in my, you know, in my life and in my sort of experiences and things I read and stuff, whatever. But learning to appreciate this movie was part of it. So, like, you know, it's a great movie. Now I understand what he meant, and I agree with him. And I don't, you know what I mean? Like, now I get it. Yeah. But the path to getting it was actually a life-changing path that I desperately needed to go through in order to not, like, be a fucking moron that died of a heart attack at 32, you know, without ever expanding his mind. You know what I mean? Right. So anyway, And acid had a lot to do with it too. Shout out to your pops. Anyway, was a huge plateau on my sort of climbing. And I don't know if I ever would have gotten to La Jetée without being able to rest on the plateau of 2001.
Right.
So
right.
Anyway, yeah. Whatever your experience was, it didn't. This is one that we didn't have, that didn't happen to us together. So I'm interested right. in yours also.
No, I mean, it took me a while to come to meet it where I needed to meet it. That I came to it as a teenager, having heard, again, this is, how incredibly influential and important and brilliant and so forth it was. And it was very much initially a relationship of respect without feeling real mm-hmm. affection for it. And I think a huge part of that, and again, like you say, this was me and not the movie, but this was sort of part of a larger thing that happened to me where, like, somewhere around Mulholland Drive was when I was finally able to let go of yes. all of my bourgeois requirements for narrative logic.
That movie and Donnie Darko broke a lot of people around our age.
Yeah.
Broke a lot of people. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm a little older than you guys, but I always thought it was... I always felt that the movies that came out in 2001 were all somehow connected to Kubrick.
Oh, that's
even
good.
Even if it didn't seem like they were. And like Donnie Darko is a movie that I don't think would exist if Kubrick hadn't existed.
No, you're right.
You know, because he made, on top of all his technical achievements and so forth. And I think it's easy to, overdo it with Kubrick. I think a lot of film buffs and critics do. He had his limitations,
sure.
I believe. But they weren't technical, that's for sure.
Yes.
And they weren't in terms of nerve.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love that, in the history of the making of the movie, Kubrick wanted to do this, and a mutual hooked him up with Arthur C. Clarke. He's like, I think Arthur C. Clarke is the guy you should talk to. And he doesn't tell Arthur C. Clarke what he's doing. He just knows Stanley Kubrick wants to talk to you, and they get together. And I would love to have been a fly on the wall.
Yeah, no kidding.
He's like, so what do you have in mind, Stanley? And he's like, okay, so I want to make a movie about the origins of human civilization and the development of technology. That from the beginning of us as humanoids through the future, when we are relieved of our corporeal status and become pure and like whatever the hell this guy said, but can you just imagine, like, he's like, oh
yeah,
I thought maybe you wanted to adapt Rendezvous with Rama, but no, actually that I know it's out of sequence. That wasn't out
sure.
yet. Don't write me letters, people. It's a joke.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I said, eventually came around to it, came to a better understanding of just the fact that, like, every film doesn't have to be like the well-made Victorian play, and have subsequently really tried to embrace that idea more as a film critic, but also as just a film viewer, as just letting a movie wash over you. And this movie, if you let it, really washes over you. The thing that was striking to me when I revisited it a couple of days ago for this is, I mean, when I told Mike that we're going to do, I said Matt picked 2001, he said, oh, great, because there's so much more to say that hasn't been said about 2001. And I reminded him that, our first episode was Godfather Part 2. And then, but then when I sat down to watch it, he's like, it is like, immediately, it's like the music that was so identifiable, the imagery, the way the title hits, like everything is, it's iconography, like immediately. Mm-hmm. And everything about it is so sort of become part of like the collective cinematic subconscious, if I don't sound too pretentious in saying that.
That's what I meant, though. It's like, how are you going to describe the Grand Canyon? Just
right.
go be, you can't even take a picture of it. You can't describe the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
You
right.
have to just go there, and you think you've seen it on
right.
billboards or whatever until you get there. And then when
right.
you get there, you're like, oh, goddammit, I really do have to get a donkey and go to the bottom of this thing, don't I? It's like you can't talk about it.
Right.
And it's, like, me personally, I don't feel smart enough to contribute to the conversation. Right. I mean, that's one of those, that was my sort of like, shit, what am I going to say? You know, it's all yeah. like sort of hard for me in a way, in a movie that is not a way people describe it. They don't describe it as a movie about heart.
Right.
You know,
right.
No, definitely not. But you know, what I kind of wanted to bring to this was, I have, to my surprise, and certainly it wasn't on my bingo card, but I've kind of become like this public advocate for the idea that it's okay for movies not to give you the answer to every question.
Mm.
And it seems as if, and I don't know if it's just the devaluation of English literacy, reading comprehension, arts mm-hmm. education, and the liberal arts generally being downplayed in favor of the sciences, which is also an area where you have to be comfortable not knowing things.
Sure.
That's sure. the vast majority of science, mm-hmm. You know, unless you're doing something that's been done before and you know what the outcome should be.
Right.
But any kind of discovery-oriented science, I don't understand why it would be hard for a scientist to, or a so-called right-brain person to appreciate a movie that ends the way this does. But I keep coming back to 2001 because I love movies that with endings that are ambiguous. But more importantly, I guess I would say agnostic endings. Mm. You know, people ask me, what do you think happens at the end of this movie? And it's like, I kind of don't really have an opinion on that.
Right.
And I'm not copping out. I'm just saying, I don't think it's that kind of movie. You know, you're supposed to figure out who killed somebody in a murder mystery because the movie doesn't tell you, and you're supposed right. to be able to figure it out on your own. Although right. I, off the top of my head, can't think of a movie that does that.
Right.
You know, it's the purest example I can think of a film that people have heard of
mm-hmm.
that doesn't chew your food for you, that makes you reach out to the movie, connect with the movie, and sort of not create your own meaning, but personalize mm-hmm. the meaning that is given to you, the facts, the images, and everything else. And yes, there's a basic story, and I think there are even, you could argue, there are some statements being made, but they're not a war is bad sort of thing. It's more like, oh, who could have thought that the humble bone club that we use to defend our tribe and you know, kill livestock for food would one day lead to an orbital nuclear weapons platform that could lob thermonuclear weaponry from orbit.
Right.
You know, it's not like, oh, the humanity. I mean, Kubrick wasn't really into that, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more, here is humanity.
Mm-hmm.
you know, if that, and I think he has that in common with some of the other great directors, like Scorsese's that way, too. I don't think Scorsese's ever endorsed anything in his life. He's not that kind of filmmaker. He's an anthropologist or an archaeologist or something. And but this movie is very uncompromising. And I think it's notable that every subsequent attempt to make a movie in the spirit of 2001 has been unable to restrain the urge to explain.
Yeah.
And some of them have it more than others, but I can't think of a single movie that, except maybe Annihilation, which came out recently,
mm.
where it doesn't at least give you something
mm-hmm.
to kill that gnawing sensation inside of you when a movie doesn't answer the questions that you want it to answer. Like, it's like, live with it. I showed it to you. Live with
yeah.
it. Think about it. I have nothing more to add to this discussion, and I respect the hell out of that. And and that's why, you know, as much as I love Close Encounters gets very close to that, but they still got to show, you know, they show you the aliens, and they show Richard Dreyfuss walking in, and you know, I think that description in the book is more accurate to Close Encounters than to 2001. I don't think there's anything in the movie to support the idea that Bowman was selected. I'm not saying I don't think he was selected, but he was the only human left alive by that point.
Right.
You know, right. So who else are they going to get?
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And also we don't know that this hasn't happened. This is probably, maybe this has happened a million times.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they figure out that we're ready to evolve and they lure one of us out to the outer, one of the outermost planets in the solar system. And then they stick us in the monolith and it does its magic and we come out as the star baby.
Right.
You know, maybe this is not the first time this has happened, or maybe right. they do it differently for every type of species. You know, maybe the other ones don't look like a human babies. They look like a, you know, a lobster. I mean, who knows? Bass. You know, I mean, whatever.
A tapir.
Exactly. It could be anything. It could be, you know, like a stapler.
Right.
It's a stapler. You know, right. With the Richard Strauss playing and there's a stapler floating, you know.
I think so often now we want to be able to make a sort of moral judgment about what the film is telling us or the perspective the film is embodying. And I mean, even when we're not mistaking that for the actual living opinions of the director or the actor or something like that, or the writer, even if we're a little bit more sort of thoughtful about it, that's just so much a part of the conversation at this point.
Yeah.
Is, you know, sort of testing our own morality against the stories that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And it has to be super fucking literal, and it has to be black and white, and it has to be able to fit on a bumper sticker. And, you know, the idea that somehow, like, we would be able to entertain a conversation about star babies coming back as lobsters the millionth and a half time ago that happened is just sort of beyond, I think, the scope of a lot of what people even think of as a reasonable version of a conversation about a piece of art, not just about a movie, but about a piece of art.
What do you think happened? You know, what do you think happened? I don't know.
Right.
Like, what do you think happened? Let's talk about that. That's
a pathway to me learning something about you that is not necessarily directly connected to your morality in a fake fucking situation, which is what so many of these conversations end up being at this point. Like, was it right for John Wick to kill all those guys over his dog? Like, did you watch the fucking movie or did you read the description? Like, and I it's nice to hear. And I think that this is one of the last like real monuments of cinema that forces that conversation. That forces it. And if you're and a lot of times people who don't like it because they're not willing, capable, or interested in having that version of a conversation.
I have to share this because I think it is germane and also I just love it. Is I took my daughter to see 2001 at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. She was a film student, high school at that time. So it wasn't like a huge, you know, she was predisposed to be into it, you know, more so than maybe a lot of teenagers would be.
Sure.
But we went to see it. Of course, this was the 30th time I'd seen it or something. And she was really like knocked out by it. And she has very adventurous tastes. So that didn't surprise me. But then what I love was when the final note had faded and they put up the credit screen, these two guys behind us, and I don't think they could have been more than 19 or 20, one of them said, what the fuck kind of ending was that? And the guy sitting next to him said, yeah, that was bullshit. And I was thinking, okay, this movie hasn't aged a day.
Yeah, there you go.
It's aged a day. And they were mad. They were actually mad.
Sure.
Like we took the N train 45 minutes to see this movie and they don't even tell us what the hell happened. What? You know?
I mean, the point, the idea that so many people want to look at movies as a problem, a puzzle to be solved, is actually something that I started thinking actively about and wrote about, ironically enough, when Room 237 came out, which is about another Kubrick movie, but this one comes into it a lot. This idea that I think has sort of almost consumed at least certain subsets of film culture where it's like, it's not actually about, with this one, for example, a sensory experience, letting a movie happen to you, giving yourself over to it, but it has to be about like unlocking the fucking Easter eggs. And it's just such a deadening way to think about a visual medium and to think about art. And I think it's sort of part and parcel with the cinema sensation of film commentary and criticism and the idea that, you know, anything that does not fall within extremely strict parameters of what we believe a movie should be and should accomplish is therefore not worth talking about.
Yeah. But is this real, or is this just like a handful of shitty people on Twitter that everybody's just like, oh, that guy sucks, oh, no, and he ruined my whole day.
No, no, no.
Like, this is the thing I keep trying to figure out, too, because there's lots of smart people that I love to read. I'm talking to two of them.
There's a culture. It's been a culture-wide problem as long as I've been alive.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right. You know, it's not, this is not, I mean, it's arguably, I don't know if it's actually gotten worse or if we just know about it because everybody has a megaphone now.
Yeah.
And you can't get away from people's terrible opinions, you know, it's just not possible. And, but I do think, you know, and I banged the drum for this when, and here's why I said Sopranos has something in common, which is that ending. And David Chase, 2001 is one of his favorite films of all time. That and Barry Lyndoner is two favorite Kubricks.
Wow.
He told me he saw 2001. He and his wife Denise saw it, and you know, they've been married forever. They saw it when it first came out, and he said they were both on psilocybin and they had it with the time of their lives. And he, you know, that was the film culture that really shaped him, that moved him out of rock and roll and into cinema, was discovering the European art films and the American films that were desperately trying to be European art films. And that started to happen in the 60s in a big way. Mm-hmm. Arguably, it was starting even sooner than that. But I think once Hiroshima Mon Amour, which is another one we should put in this on this shelf of don't worry, don't get too hung up on what it means.
Yeah.
I don't, which is not to say it's meaningless or things done to it for effect, but that's not the point of it. But
you could spend 10 minutes talking about every minute of that movie, though.
Right.
Like, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, the arrival practically back to back of Hiroshima Mon Amour and Breathless I believe Kind of Blue might have been the same year. I think that really cracked open a lot of preconceived notions for people. Who were of an age to be impressionable still. Like, I mean, teens, 20s, maybe early 30s. And then I think people's tastes generally start to harden a bit after that. Not always. But that's where the European art cinema started to go mainstream. You'd hear jokes about Ingmar Bergman on The Tonight Show. Mm. You know, there's a joke about Romare in the Gene Hackman film,
yes,
Night Moves. And they talk about it as a thing that a reasonably intelligent adult living in a major city would be expected to have heard about.
Totally.
And perhaps to have seen and have an opinion on. And he says it was like watching paint dry, which is a perfectly valid opinion. But the point is, I don't, you know, not that I agree with it, but it's perfectly valid for someone to feel that way about any filmmaker.
Yeah.
But you know, that's not really the culture anymore. And and the inability to accept any sort of ambiguity at all. And even to the point of, like, it's not just like, what does the ending of Inception mean? Well, I don't think that Inception is like quite the brain teaser on the level of like a 2001 or a Solaris, but sure. Much respect to Christopher Nolan for making film after film after film where you don't ask what did that mean, although in Inception I think you do, but more why is he telling the story this way?
Right.
Mm.
Which I think is just as valid of a question, and it also leads you to think about what you want out of a movie like Oppenheimer. Why is half the movie devoted to his security clearance issues? And what does the final shot of that tell us about the subject? Not just Oppenheimer himself, but the entire canvas. What does it tell you? What is this movie? What do you think this movie is about? And what do you think it's actually about? These are all questions that you can ask and be asked after seeing a movie like Oppenheimer or Donnie Darko, not the director's cut.
No.
He should have quit while he was ahead. You know, but again, it's like he started to explain things, and that's when he kind of lost me. And so many of these movies that wanted to be 2001 that came afterwards, and a lot of them are, you know, by people who were a little younger than Kubrick and grew up idolizing him, they don't quite hit. And I think one of the reasons is because they do give us more. They lose their nerve, like Brian De Palma's Mission to Mars, which I know probably not entirely his fault, but you get to the end and they're talking. There's an alien talking to you, and you get to the end of AI, which I think is a masterpiece. I think it's on the level of the best Kubrick stuff. But they have a lot of explaining at the end of that too.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of explaining, even in Solaris. I watched Solaris again recently, and Solaris is one of the most uncompromising science fiction films ever made. But there's a scene where they explain exactly what's going on.
Right.
In a way that, like, I didn't need.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. No. I don't want to be a downer, but it does seem like we're in a kind of a hostile environment to movies and any kind of art that is like this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I mean about, like, Solaris even is one of those things where it's like, you know, it didn't bother me, but I also didn't need it. Like, the point was, like you said, in like the first 20 minutes or whatever, like the lake is a brain. You know what I mean?
Right, so it's right, like, right, right.
You said that early on, and then the rest of the movie has been an exploration of that. So, like, the sort of back end explanation of it was sort of unnecessary and felt to me like, you know, a producer's note.
Have either of you guys read Space Odyssey, the book by Michael Benson?
No.
Okay, so this is one of the best books about the making of a single film that I've ever read. It's great.
Bailey's picking it up tomorrow.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'll tell you, it's filled with anecdotes where you can amaze your friends. you'll be the most popular person at the film nerd party if you've read this book. Because I've read probably, if there was a book that has been published about Kubrick, either a biography or a critical study or whatever, I've probably read it. Mm. I may even own it. And this is the best book about 2001 that I've ever come across. And there's stuff in here I just didn't know. I don't know if anybody knew this stuff. And here, I'm just going to give you the two big ones.
Okay.
Because here we are, like, I'm praising, oh, the ambiguity, yay.
Right.
Isn't that great that he didn't tell us this and he didn't show us that? Well, here's the thing. Even he wanted to give us more.
Really?
Wow.
So they get out to England to shoot the movie. And they need an object that became the monolith, but it wasn't a monolith originally. It was more like a pyramid or a tesseract shape. And they get this props company called Frankenstein and Sons to build this object. I know, and isn't it perfect considering the HAL 9000 storyline?
Yes.
Right? And they tell him, look, it's not going to work. We can't really do this. We can't really make this shape, this molded shape that is basically a pyramid or a tesseract. And you're not going to be able to see through it. We can't make it out of glass. It's just impossible, and it's dangerous, and you'll never keep it clean. It's always going to look dirty. Can we make another shape? And they decided, well, let's try a rectangle type shape. Like, well, you know, it's like we have better luck with 90 degree angles generally.
Sure.
And he's like, fine. So let's go with a shape. It's basically like a domino. But Kubrick is still hung up on the idea that you got to be able to see through it. And so they make it out of lucite.
Okay.
But then they bring it over to the studio. It weighs like a half a ton or something. They go to great trouble to prop it up and on the, you know, the ape set. And he looks at it through the viewfinder and he's like, it looks like a huge bar of soap. Take it away. And his producer says, you know what? We went to all this trouble. I'm totally paraphrasing this and embellishing, but we went to all this trouble. Let's see if there's some other solution. And somebody in his prop department's like, well, we could paint it a color. Well, how about black? And Kubrick, by this point, is probably depressed as hell. He's like, can I get the thing I want? Why is it so hard to get the thing I want?
Right.
And then they bring in the black monolith and they prop it up and he looks at it and he's like, huh.
Hmm.
Okay.
Wow.
You know, so that's not to say that Kubrick wasn't this incredibly anal retentive.
Sure.
He's in everybody's business 24/7, all of that. It's just to say that he's as open to serendipity and willing to roll with the punches as anybody else who's serious about their art.
Yeah.
Right. So the monolith was the monolith because the thing he wanted to make, he couldn't get made. Right.
Wow.
So here comes the killer. All the way through the movie, he wanted to show you the creatures. The aliens, the AI, whatever it is, he wanted to show it. All through the production, the intention was to show it, but he kept putting it off and putting it off because none of the solutions that his team was coming up with were making him happy. And his number one directive was, I don't want you to bring me anything that looks like something I've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
This has to look completely new. And the problem is the human mind cannot conceive of something that doesn't have any reference.
Right.
something you already know. And then, so people are probably bringing him like, looks like an octopus, take it away. looks like a jellyfish, take it away. Looks like whatever. So he keeps putting it off, and all through pre-production, all through production, and then all the way at the end of post-production, they still haven't dealt with it. And so finally he gets the actor who played Moonwatcher, the main ape, you know, who picks up the bone.
Right.
They put him in, it's like the phrase, my God, it's full of stars, which doesn't get used until 2010. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what this was going to be. It's like the idea was you see a sea of stars, and then you realize some of the stars are moving oddly, and then this thing comes out of the stars, like towards you. And so they got this actor who played Moonwatcher. They put him in a bodysuit. They put some little lights on him that matched the star field perfectly, and they were going to like lower him down out of wires, and they start shooting it, and Kubrick's looking at this and he's like, cut, cut, cut. This looks ridiculous.
This is stupid.
It looks ridiculous. It's like Ed Wood level. He's like, no. And that's why you don't see the aliens.
Wow.
They ran out of time. They ran out of money. And that's why you don't see the aliens. And like, what's the one thing that I point to? Yeah. And I think so many people appreciate is that they don't actually show you the thing that's making all this stuff happen, which I think is the masterstroke of the movie. And it wasn't on purpose, or was it? Or was it? Because I said, you know, David Chase was sitting for interviews with me and Alan Sepinwall for the Sopranos sessions. And we were going into some kind of incredible chain of like, things that just seemed like they'd been plotted and planned. I think it had to do with Ralphie Cifaretto and how he was introduced and how he died and all this other stuff. And he said, I got to be honest with you. I don't think we had any of that in mind. I don't think we did any of that premeditated. And I said, so you didn't do it on purpose. And he's like, no, but then again, maybe.
Right.
And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, when a bunch of people are working on a thing together for a long period of time, they start to figure out what this thing is and like things that this type of thing would do start to happen in the story. And like, so it might have been a hive mind thing where like everybody's on the same page and they produce what looks like this absolutely beautifully executed, premeditated thing. And it wasn't like, it was like, it's not like they didn't mean to do it. It's more like in the original Star Wars when Luke Skywalker turns off the targeting computer and uses the Force.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that he didn't make that shot. It means he you know, leave it to Jesus, as they say in Texas. You know?
There you have it. There you have it. Beautiful.
That is
said.
An amazing story about a guy who like supposedly dusted every fucking rock, man. That's such a beautiful story.
Yeah, you know? I just like the idea of him being defeated. Yeah, him being like, he's like, I'm sorry, Stan. How often do you think he heard we can't do that? That's probably a fireable offense. And they're like, dude, I've been your friend for 15 years, and I'm just telling you, we can't do
it. We can't do it.
Like, what if this? It's like, we still can't do it.
Yep. Then you know what? You don't do it, and then it's better.
It's better that way. If he'd shown us the creature, maybe it wouldn't have been thought of as fondly.
That's right. Maybe we wouldn't be talking about it almost 60 years later.
No.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk about the movie's release and reception. All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of 2001 A Space Odyssey, which opened at Lowe's Capitol Theater in New York on April 3rd, 1968. This is fascinating. Same day as Planet of the Apes. Amusing. Considering how 2001 opens. Also opening that week, Kubrick's Strangelove star Peter Sellers in Blake Edwards' The Party, and Burt Lancaster in Sidney Pollack's The Scalp Hunters. Also in New York on that day, Godard's Le Chiennes, Claude Lelouch's A Man and a Woman, 2001 star Keir Duala in The Fox, which we discussed on our 1967 episode of Very Good Year. The Fun City movies Madigan, No Way to Treat a Lady, and The Producers were all in theaters. The 1967 releases The Graduate, Dr. Dolittle, Valley of the Dolls, Bonnie and Clyde, and The Battle of Algiers were all still in theaters because movies used to stay in theaters for longer than a month. We had a big re-release of Chaplin's The Gold Rush and a big re-release of Gone with the Wind in 70mm widescreen, which, if I understand aspect ratios right, and I think I do, means that they were showing it with the tops and bottoms of the frame cut off. Well done. Well done, studios. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
Breaking.
The middle of Gone with the Wind looks amazing. Okay. Yeah. April 3rd, 1968. It was springtime and the automatic rifles were cracking in Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
Big article on the front page of the Gray Lady about the hot war called the Democratic Primary, where only 3 days before, President Johnson said he would not pursue or accept the nomination of his party.
Right.
Eugene McCarthy won the first contest after Johnson's announcement in Wisconsin. And then the Times wrote a whole front page article about Senator McCarthy's plans to keep people from voting for Robert Kennedy. God damn it, history sucks.
Sometimes.
Yeah, it does. Sucks.
Yeah.
In New York City news, Mayor Lindsay asked the city council to give him emergency powers to ban the sale of firearms and alcoholic beverages and to impose a curfew during outbreaks of civil disobedience. When do you think the firearm thing became permanent? I can look it up right now, but that's not how this segment works. So for now, just know that if you saw a riot going on in April 1968, you could buy a goddamn gun during the riot and go have some fun. Lindsay often seems like a pedantic, anxious white boy to me, but I gotta give it to him on this one. Whew. And finally, a representative sample of 1,512 adults were interviewed in mid-March on their opinions of the Vietnam War.
Oh, right.
Ready for this?
Yep.
51% thought we should continue bombing North Vietnam in 1968.
Yeah.
But at the same time, 56% of respondents said they would approve of a gradual withdrawal from Vietnam if the government said they wanted to do that. I don't entirely understand. It's one of those like, well, I think we probably shouldn't be doing it, but if we're going to do it, fuck it. Let's really do it.
Right.
You know, like, let's go all in on digging this hole that none of us should be in. It feels like when you hear about the polls of Martin Luther King's speeches and most of America, like, somehow disapprove.
Right.
We are an angry, self-protective, and superstitious people. Get off my fucking lawn, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't deserve 2001. Jason, what did the critics have to say about this fine film?
Well, it was hella polarizing among critics in 1968. Let us begin, as we typically do, with the Times, the New York Times, where Renata Adler wrote, "The special effects in the movie are the best I have ever seen, and the number of ways in which the movie conveys visual information, there is very little dialogue, drives it into an outer limit of the visual. And yet, the uncompromising slowness of the movie makes it hard to sit through without talking, and people on all sides when I saw it were talking almost throughout the film. Very annoying. With all its attention to detail, a kind of reveling in its own IQ, the movie acknowledged no obligation to validate its conclusion for those, me for example, who are not science fiction buffs. By the end, the three unreconciled plot lines, the slabs, Dolea's aging, the period bedroom, are simply left there like a Rorschach with murky implications of theology. However,
what the fuck?
In his 4-star review, Roger Ebert wrote, "The fascinating thing about this film is that it fails on the human level, but succeeds magnificently on a cosmic scale. There is hardly any character development in the plot, then, as a result, little suspense. What remains fascinating is the fanatic care with which Kubrick has built his machines and achieved his special effects. There is not a single moment in this long film when the audience can see through the props. The stars look like stars, and outer space is bold and bleak." End quote.
He touched on something there, though, that Perry gets to in his review, which was something I had never considered before, which is the idea that Hal is actually more of a human than the humans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we watched the Soderbergh cut, and like it hadn't occurred to me when watching that's actually what makes the Soderbergh cut works so well outside of just the rhythm of his editing is the idea that like we're taking on the perspective of the paranoid, you know, neurotic is not a word I would have necessarily applied to this computer, but it certainly fits once you hear it. And Ebert sort of gets to that and sort of comments on that here, the fanatic care with which he's built his machines. I understand he's not just talking about Hal in the way that Perry was, but that little bit landed for me.
The New Republic's Stanley Kaufman, on the other hand, called it, quote, a film that is so dull, it even dulls our interest in the technical ingenuity for the sake of which Kubrick has allowed it to become dull. He is so infatuated with technology, of film and of the future, that it has numbed his formerly keen feeling for attention span. Even the New Yorker was split within about the picture.
Boo, Stanley Kaufman, boo. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So yeah, the New Yorker is at war within itself about the picture. Penelope Gillette got the first crack at it, calling it upon its release some sort of great film and an unforgettable endeavor. Technically and imaginatively, what he put into it is staggering. 5 years of his life, his novel and screenplay with Arthur C. Clarke, his production, his direction, his special effects, his humor and stamina and particular disquiet. The film is not only hideously funny, like Dr. Strangelove, about human speech and response at a point at which they seem to have begun to have seemed computerized and where more and more people sound like recordings left on while the soul is out. It is also a uniquely poetic piece of sci-fi made by a man who truly possesses the drives of both science and fiction. But months later, in her seminal essay, Trash, Art, and the Movies, Pauline Kael wrote, 2001 is a movie that might have been made by the hero of Blow Up, and it's fun to think about Kubrick really doing every dumb thing he wanted to do, building enormous science fiction sets and equipment, never even bothering to figure out what he was going to do with them. Fellini, too, had gotten carried away with the Erector Set approach to movie making, but his big science fiction construction exposed to view at the end of 8 and a half was abandoned. Kubrick never really made his movie either, but he doesn't seem to know it. Some people like the American International Pictures stuff because it's rather idiotic, and maybe some people love 2001 just because Kubrick did all that stupid stuff and acted out a kind of super sci-fi nuts fantasy. End quote. I love her so much, and there's even a couple of great lines in there, and I don't agree.
I'm finding out that I love her in pieces. This show, there's been several fine movies that it's like, bro, did you spend half that movie in the shitter on the phone? Like, what are you even talking about?
That's like, you just reminded me of my favorite line from the second Spider-Verse movie, which is, I have had exactly the right amount of you.
Mike, how did 2001 do in terms of box office and awards?
It earned $8.5 million in its roadshow release in 1968, and then doubled and doubled. And at this point, Box Office Mojo puts its worldwide box office at $66 million before adjusting for inflation.
And who knows how many people have never seen it in it? That's theatrical rentals,
right?
It's a very successful film, and it's certainly, I would argue, I can't really think of an exception to this, the most financially successful art film ever released by an American studio, which is not a long list. It's not like there's a ton of movies that could compete with it, but certainly, you know, this was a popular success on the level where, you know, I always say that the difference between a success and a hit is a success reaches more or less everybody who might have wanted to see it, but a hit, people who have never would have thought to go to this movie are going to see it because their friends have been talking about it.
Right.
And when it's a mega hit, people are going to see it who don't even go to the movies very much. Right. And 2001 was in that weight class for, you know, probably the first 6 or 7 years after it was released. I mean, like, what can you say? I mean, there's entire books have been and will be written about not just the production of this movie, but the roads that it paved. And I say roads, plural. I don't think Spielberg and Lucas would have done what they did without 2001 to point to.
You know,
and it was incredibly difficult for both of them to get those films made. Spielberg got his made because Jaws made so much money they couldn't say no to him. But it was still like, really? Because it cost $18 million to make Close Encounters in 1977, which is, I don't know how much that is now, but it's like, it would be a kind of a really, they mm-hmm. gave him that much to do this, mm-hmm. but people loved it. That was another movie that where there was really no reason to think that a film like that would be a smash hit, but it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have an example right now, which is Sinners. Sinners is now at the point where people who don't even go to the movies are right. going to the movies to see it. And it's on video.
Right.
And it all comes back, not that they have anything in common story-wise or thematically, but just, you know, you've never seen anything quite like this is actually a pretty good selling point.
And, I mean, I've seen it, you know, a couple times in a theater. I paid for the 70mm run a couple years ago, but I've watched it, you know, on my television more than anything else. And I think that's, you know, that obviously doesn't figure in.
Well, it's, and, you know, to take it back to the beginning of the conversation, it is a perfect illustration of another thing that I say to the point when people get wanting to stick a sock in my mouth and make me shut up about it is there's movies can be more than one thing.
Mm-hmm.
There movies can be all sorts of things. And, you know, these rules that people make money putting in little paperback books and selling them to people who want to get rich writing a screenplay, which almost no one can do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They try to make a code or a list or something. It's like, this must happen. Act one, act two, act three. 2001 breaks pretty much any rule that had existed up to that point and every rule that has been invented since. Like, there's no protagonist except maybe the human race, I guess, would be the protagonist. And it's not three acts. It's four. It's not even four acts, but I would say four movements.
Yes.
Like in a symphony, it's a symphonic work. And it even begins with like the, it sounds like the orchestra is tuning up when you see that black screen. It hits me personally. And I think a lot of people too. And like in the way that a great piece of music does, you know, my favorite piece of classical music is probably Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And I've listened to, I don't even know how many different versions of it. If my entire extended family's life depended on me humming all of Beethoven's Ninth, they'd be fine. We'd be eating pennies that night, you know? And 2001 is that way for me too. And I appreciate it in the same way. Like, I feel like it's carrying me aloft
mm-hmm.
on its sounds and its images and making me think. And, you know, even like not just the sort of higher level, I'm going to write a thesis about this type of ideas, but just little things like, why are some things circles and other things are squares?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are some things angular and other things devoid of angles in the visual scheme of the movie? Like the circular shapes and versus the squares and the rectangles. I've never quite figured out like what the pattern is, but it feels
but
like
there's really, something there.
I think mm-hmm. there might be something there or maybe there isn't. And that's fine too.
Yes.
You know,
there
and,
you have it.
And and also like, does he go into the monolith? Does he physically go into the monolith? Does the monolith pull him in? Is that a stargate? Is it like a fabric opening up in the universe and he's going somewhere else? We don't know what it is. And mm-hmm. we still don't know. No one can explain to us what it actually is because no one knows.
Mm.
And not to get too grandiose, but why not?
Why not?
Why not? I think that, honest to God, I think that a lot of the pushing back against letting an ambiguous ending just be, let the mystery be, as that song mm-hmm. goes, that used to be the credits for The Leftovers, let the mystery be, mm-hmm. you know, surf the mystery, ride the mystery, go inside of the mystery, you know, paint the mystery, write a novel about it, but don't try to solve it. It's not supposed to be solved. That's not why it's there.
Despite the tough competition from Funny Girl, The Mystery was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Art Direction, and Best Special Visual Effects. And I hate to like, that would never happen now, but like you called it an art movie. You called it the most successful art movie of all time, but I feel like that's pretty impressive. It was not nominated for Best Picture, and the only prize it won was for special effects because Funny Girl was cool, but special effects? Come on.
Yeah.
Well, here's what I think is kind of funny is 1968 was the year that they gave a special achievement in makeup to Planet of the Apes.
Right.
Now, I love the makeup in Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. I think that's the perfect makeup for the kind of film that is.
Totally.
Like, they're supposed to be like people, but they're monkeys. They're right. apes, right? That you're not fooling them into thinking they're gorillas. However,
right. Right.
there was another movie yeah. where they mixed people in ape suits with actual baby chimpanzees, yep. and people just didn't even think that these might not be real apes. So wouldn't you think that that's what
yeah.
should, and I think it was might have been Kubrick who said, like, I think the reason that they didn't give us that award is because they thought these apes were real. You know?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
It was up for Best Picture at the BAFTAs, and it did not win that one, but it did take home 3 for Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography, and Best Soundtrack.
So there we go.
Unexpected.
There we go.
But good anyway.
Yeah.
What do they mean by soundtrack? Did they mean like sound design or something?
I think so, and sort of the entirety of effects and the mix and the music, and I think just that's a nice big all-encompassing thing for the BAFTAs, at least in that particular mm-hmm. era.
Another little detail I want to share, just in case people don't already know it, is all the scenes where the astronauts, where you hear them going, that's Kubrick.
Wow. Nice.
Because it was the thing where it's like nobody could give him quite the panicked
of
breathing
course.
That he wanted, and so he's like, all right, I'll do it.
Fuck it, I'll do it myself.
Sometimes you got to give these fucking cows a line reading, you know what I mean? Sometimes you got to show them how it's done.
Yep. There you go.
That's great. He's like he's like tearing his shirt off, like, really in that booth.
All right. Now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Matt, you're our guest, which means you go first.
2001, there's so many movies you could put it with and have a really fruitful, mm-hmm. fun evening, but I'm going to go with Annihilation.
Mm.
Because I think it's, you know, as great, it's a great science fiction movie, in my opinion, and it also is, in its own way, as uncompromised as 2001.
Very good. My choice is much less highfalutin. Here's the thing. I saw The Groove Tube before I saw 2001. And I don't know, Matt, if you're making a face. I don't know if you remember how The Groove...
Just like The Groove Tube, I'm like, you know...
The Groove Tube.
A title I have not heard since, you know...
But
The Groove Tube.
It has a sequence that parodies the ape sequence in 2001, where Move On Up by Curtis Mayfield creeps into the soundtrack and the apes start boogieing. And I swear to God, every time I watch 2001 now, when I watch that scene, Move On Up creeps into my brain.
That's great.
So I think it would make a fine double feature. I think you start with 2001, you do it in the correct order, but you'll very much enjoy at least the 2001 satire in The Groove Tube. Mike, what's your pick?
I think you're suggesting that Man didn't reach his final form until Move On Up came out. Is that really what you're actually suggesting?
I think it is. I think it might be, and I think that might be accurate. Yes.
I like it. My choice is mentioned earlier, actually, and I would like to say, like, this is a double feature that you should watch on back-to-back days, not both of them at the same time.
Right.
But, like, I had a similar but much smaller plateau with Solaris, with the, you know, Tarkovsky
yes.
Solaris, because, like, Bradford Young brought Stalker. He did 1979, and he brought Stalker, and I was like, that movie absolutely, I just loved it mm-hmm. immediately, and for the duration, and then the 3 times I watched it after that, like, I just was so amazed by it. So then I was like, who the fuck is this? And, you know, you read the quote about Breton, you know, I only care about 2 people's opinion, and their name are Breton and Bresson, like, whatever, like, it's just like, you know, okay, I gotta know more about this guy. And then I put on Solaris and I fell asleep, and then I put it on again later, and I tried to watch it again, and I was like, this is just, you know, remember, like, you grew up in the 80s. You remember when you would see pictures of like Russian cars and you were like, that don't look like a fucking Camaro, you know, like they were making terrible ripoffs of British and American shit. And the second time I tried to watch Solaris as a fully grown fucking human being, this is like a year and a half ago, I was like, this is low rent, but this is Russian 2001. I just sort of wrote it off. Like by the time they got to the space station, I was like, nah.
Anytime I don't like anything, I'm going to go, that doesn't look like a fucking Camaro.
There you go.
Be like my new takedown line.
Good.
But then when I finally was like, no, bro, like you can't make Stalker and also then make ripoff 2001. There's something here that I'm not sort of getting. And I went back to it and I went back to it. And what I've sort of pieced together is like Arthur C. Clarke was a mythologist. And it was a myth writer and was a futurist, was literally a title that he took. Mm. And the way Arthur C. Clarke tells stories, there is a Godhead. There is an answer, even if we don't get every bit of it. There is a hero's journey. He is sort of, was so sort of locked in as a creator and just as a person to sort of the Western myth style that the movie ultimately can actually be seen in that way in a lot of ways, especially if you look at him and his first story that it was sort of based on and just sort of put it in the context of his career. And the guy that wrote fucking Solaris was too smart for his own good Jew in communist controlled Poland. He was living in a whole other fucking universe. And Solaris has, even though they give you the answer, the sort of tech answer to what happened, they don't, there's a lot more fear. It's the fear is much more tangible and the confusion is much more tangible. It's like they find this monolith on the moon and they go there confident they're going to figure out what the fuck it is. And it may not or not work. They may not really figure it out, but they go with, there with the sort of confidence of like, yeah, we're going to work this out. When the guys go into the space station in Solaris, he has no confidence.
Right.
He is not aggressive. He is not sure. He's scared to fucking death. And it just feels like the sort of emotions that it took me until I was maybe 47 or 48 to even be able to connect to. Right. Of the sort of like accepting that like, we're not ever going to know the answer to this mystery. And even if we know the lake is the thing, how the fuck did the lake become sentient? It's just all of these sort of like, and how we then react to it. And like there's a sort of like a thing aspect where like nobody trusts each other in there. And they're all, I don't know, man. It's a lot of the things that are sort of wrapped up in 2001, but it's much messier. Everybody's neurotic, not just Hal. And it's sort of, it feels to me like it was a sort of another plateau, another sort of level of maturity to be able to sort of figure out what he was trying to do with that movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'll tell you what I love about that movie, and it didn't really sink in until I started watching it again a few years ago. And, I love it. And it's that I think the key question of that movie is if you found out that that something that you loved or that you believed in was not real, would it bother you?
Mm.
And, you know, this is a guy who's widowed and he gets onto the space station and the sentient lake brings a facsimile of his wife back and he doesn't care.
He doesn't.
Does he know that she's not real? We don't even really get into that. It's kind of like, there's another guy on the station. Who's like, you know, she's not real. Right? And he's like, anyway, my wife and I are going off for a while. We're going to, you know,
bro, like, are you like nihilist and realistic enough to just take the fucking blue pill because it don't matter anyway?
Right. Well, that's right? It. And you mentioned that, and it's the scene, you know, and that's the scene. One of my favorite scenes in The Matrix is when Cypher is eating the steak that doesn't exist. And he's like, I don't care if this is not real steak.
Like understanding that, like being able to like understand that that is a choice that you might just fuck around and make as a person who's dealt with enough like hard shit in life and has maybe sort of run out of hope. And I mean, right. And it, like, I feel like everybody, it doesn't matter what you've sort of gone through or experienced in your life, what successes you've had, whatever the fuck, you have to have that moment where you're like, you know what? Fuck these kids. I'm going to the circus or jumping in a lake or whatever. You know what I mean? And that, yeah. like, and I just feel like that to me is so powerful now. Yeah. And I wouldn't, at 35, I never would have understood it. At 25, yeah. I wouldn't have even finished the first 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, pair it with, but maybe double it up with Solaris with like 10 years in between the movies, depending on how old you are. I don't know, but at least one day, because they're too much.
There you go. Know,
yeah, it'll take too much coffee to get through them both in one evening. All right, you guys are such good writers. Your recommendations were like three sentences. I've been talking for 30 fucking minutes to make my point. Oh, man.
Matt, where can people follow you on social media?
Well, my name on Blue Sky, also the bookstore's address, which is Judith's account is MZS Press at Blue Sky.
Let's plug that site a little bit, because I think it's especially, I find myself sending people there to buy stuff, especially now that we're in this, like, no, Amazon is actual true evil. don't buy yeah. your fucking books from them. Like, go to a real independent bookstore. But like, you guys, you stock new books, you've got signed books, you've got a couple of mine signed, you've got many of yours signed, many of our colleagues and friends have books there, but also you're like, you guys are out like treasure hunting in used bookstores. Like, I've gotten so much great stuff from MZS stuff.
We're sitting on, like, there aren't enough hours of the day, but we're sitting on a massive amount of stuff that's going to be new to the customers. But like, you know, we, the church that we go to sold off, you know, they decided to redo their library and they got rid of all these old and out of print religion books. So we grabbed a bunch of those, you know, and like, you know, I'll go to Goodwill. If, you know, if there's one in a shopping center that we're going to, I'll pop in and see if they have any. It's amazing how much good stuff you find. Yeah. I found a first edition of Caleb Carr's The Alienist at a Goodwill one time.
Nice.
You know, it's great stuff. But, you know, the most important thing for me is, making it so that people are excited about reading and books and talking about books and just putting books in the hands of people. And I had two jobs in college. Three, if you count work study at the film archives, but I worked at a movie theater, the Inwood in Dallas. And at the same time I was working at the SMU bookstore.
Mm.
And, you know, here I am now in my 50s and I'm doing programming at theaters, and I'm, you know, got a bookstore with Judith that's all stuff that we like.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like, it's there. If it's there, it's because we decided to put it there. We don't have any list of what we should put in.
Right.
You know, it's like those, New York particularly is filled with them, but you know, there's sometimes you just walk in a neighborhood, you come across an independent bookstore and there's like three cats and you're like, you're walking around and you're like, wow, there's an entire section devoted to eggs.
Yes.
I've never seen that before. Like, well, that's our store.
There you go.
We have an entire section on Mad Men. We have an entire section on David Lynch, you know, dedicated Miyazaki, you know, so. Anyway, but thank you for letting me plug that, because it is increasingly the center of who I am.
Yep. And that's, you know, when anyone asks me, when you write a book, people say, okay, well, where can I buy it that will help you the most? And I always send them to your site, because it's like, I don't know if it's going to help me any better, but it's going to put a little money in this guy's pocket. So that's the best.
That's wonderful.
There we go.
That's wonderful. It came about during the pandemic, partly because artists couldn't travel.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't go to book events. You weren't supposed to do that. So that was a way for people who were never going to be able to attend a book signing to get a signed edition. And, you know, it kind of ballooned from there. But it's a lot of fun. And we got a lot of sci-fi books, if anybody cares.
There you go. And and a lot of Kubrick books as well. So, you know.
Yeah.
Pair it up. I am Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I am Fifth Column Films on Instagram and Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please leave us a rating and or review on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get our weekly show notes and such, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation and support us in the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And if you're one of those weirdos who likes to watch videos of people recording a podcast, you'll find us on YouTube on our channel, Guide for the Film Fanatic. So hello if you're watching us right there.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. And shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, who I hear has given his daughter a bush baby for her birthday.
Thank you again, Matt.
Thank you for having me, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. On the next Guide for the Film Fanatic, the great Stephen Rebello joins us to discuss Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train and his new book about it, Crisscross. See you then.
Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior Paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money.